Without further ado, let's speak with our first guest today on Newsline. Today is World Mental Health Day. And joining us live on Newsline is Romy Drucker, Education Program Director, the Walton Family Foundation, to talk about this very important issue. Romy, before we get into this study that really looks at Gen Z, why is it important to have a day for mental health awareness, Mental Health Day?
No matter who you are, you want to feel mentally healthy. And so I think it's great that we have a space as communities and as people to talk about what it is that unlocks that feeling of joy and happiness inside of us. And as we know, that's especially important for our young people. We want them to feel like they're thriving. So thank you for having me on.
Well, it is great to have you. And I have to tell you personally, I have three Gen Zers, right? These are kids born between the late 90s and early 2000s, correct? And those are the young people you studied that you have new data on?
So this latest survey, yes, it captures the perspectives of young people ages 12 to 26, and it is a partnership with Gallup, and two key findings. One, young people don't feel prepared for their futures. They are saying that school isn't setting them up for success. And two, they're struggling with their mental health. Only 20% of Gen Zers surveyed say that their mental health is excellent. So we need to be having a different conversation about academic, social, and emotional supports for young people right now.
Yeah, Romy, so many questions about this. Let's start with the first thing you said, that they don't feel prepared. What do the surveyors actually mean by prepared, and why don't they feel prepared?
So when we asked students in the survey if they've learned something interesting at school in the past few days, a majority of them said they hadn't. What we're learning is that young people, of course, want school to feel relevant. They want it to feel like a place where they can find their purpose and figure out what it is they want to do in life. And high school just isn't serving them in that way. So we need to be thinking about how to change up the high school experience, giving students more exposure to career-connected opportunities, to work-based learning experiences, and letting them explore what it is that unlocks their passion and also what it is that doesn't make them feel a sense of fulfillment.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I remember with my younger two children during the course of high school, they got some sort of a survey asking them questions about themselves with an eye to trying to determine what careers they might like to pursue. And I think it was helpful. They sort of knew they were among the lucky kids who kind of had an idea of what they wanted to study in college. But I don't know, Romy, is it good to do that, to, give them the skills to determine what they want to do post high school? Or does it put pressure on them to say, well, you better figure it out before you go to college what you want to do?
I think it's really about allowing students to have agency over their education and to explore. So it's not about saying in high school, this is what the rest of my life is going to look like. But it is about having internships and mentors and access to an understanding of what even are the jobs of the future that I could pursue. And so finding ways to integrate that into school, finding ways to allow students to try different things and move on to other things. We know there are multiple pathways for young people. Some are going to go to college. Some are going to go right into the workforce. And so giving them the information and letting them make choices about what it is that makes them feel excited about their next steps.
Yeah, opening their eyes to a field that maybe they were not aware of. That could certainly be helpful. Back to some of the stats from this new data on Gen Z. And again, we're talking about young people born between the late 90s, early 2000s. 78% don't feel that they can succeed. How so?
So 78% feel that they don't feel that they can succeed, and yet a majority of the Gen Zers in this survey also say they're hopeful about their future. So what do we make of that? School needs to be a place that can address this issue and helping students feel more prepared. So practical skills, this is what we're hearing from young people. As it pertains to what it means to be in the working world, how do I write a resume? How do I show up in a way that feels professional? How do I, you know, network and build connections and social capital that are going to serve me in the long run? So again, there are high schools out there that have figured out how to do the foundational academic work and then provide students with experiences and projects that let them develop these skill sets that are relevant to how to succeed in the long run.
How early or how young should kids even be thinking about that and asking those questions?
We know of middle schools that are actually focused on this. I know in Denver they do a middle school career fair where young people get exposed to careers even that early. So I think it's never too early to start having the conversation while ensuring that we're letting students be curious and explore and recognize that their K-12 journey is about really trying out new things and that they don't have to make a decision early on about where they want to go, but also knowing that we want them to find those things that make them feel motivated.
Right, and give them a little help finding them and setting them maybe on a career path. So, Romy, we were talking about giving kids the skills and the knowledge that they need to succeed. This new survey about Gen Z also takes a close look at their mental health. And you mentioned this at the very top of our conversation. Only 21% say that their mental health is excellent. First of all, before we get into why that might be, do you know any more about how this survey defines excellent mental health?
I think we asked students about what makes them feel a sense of happiness. And one of the good things is that students do feel like they're having opportunities to feel happy. It's just not consistent enough to support their mental well-being. And so that's why we need to look at structures at school where they spend most of their time. Parents play a role in this, helping to provide that continuity and support and a listening ear. But I think if we're going to solve this challenge, it can't just be moments of joy. It has to be joyful contexts for young people.
Mm-hmm. And the other part of it, so 31%, if I'm reading this correctly, say their mental health is fair or poor. How is that defined?
We know that young people are facing a range of challenges, anxiety, depression, nervousness, just a lack of overall confidence. And as you noted, like some of this became exacerbated by the pandemic, by falling behind in school, and also because of the sense of loneliness that young people felt, being disconnected from friends, from civic institutions and social groups. So I think especially now figuring out how to build those connections and let students be themselves and have experiences that are authentic is the thing that's really going to unlock for them that sense that they are on a path to success and feeling good about their trajectory.
Yeah, during the pandemic, I felt like I saw kids, obviously they could only interact through technology, right? They weren't allowed to be with each other in person. Do you think that we're still feeling the residual effects of that? In other words, are kids still a little bit more likely to just text somebody versus texting them and setting up a get together to be in person and to shore up those treasured friendships?
I do think we're still feeling the after effects, and we'll continue to understand through research, you know, the long-term impact of the pandemic. On learning, we know that the learning loss is really significant and still compounding in a lot of ways. On the sort of social and emotional front for students, they lost what it means to sort of be a child and have fun and have, you know, the kinds of experiences and connections that are so critical to developing a young person's character. So again, it's just such a timely moment to be having this conversation because I think we all need to be putting our heads together on more we can be doing for young people right now.
Right. I feel like you touched on this. You mentioned the word parents, right? So as a parent, and this is a very broad question, but what can we do to make sure our kids have good mental health? And I'm sure, you know, you could give me a half hour's worth of advice on that. But basically, How much should we be checking in about that?
Yeah, well, sometimes as a parent, it can feel like your young person doesn't want to engage with you on a topic like mental health or what their future might hold. And what we learned in this latest survey is that students and young people do want to engage with their parents on these topics. They want to be listened to, and they want their parents to be the role of guide and advice giver even. And so the best sort of advice that we have and that, you know, psychologists we're working with have is just to stick with these conversations. They may not happen all at once, but keep going and trying to have them.
Yeah. You walk a fine line, right? As a parent, you don't want to be a nudge, but I found it helpful to just say, "Look, you know, you seem a little down in the dumps. If you want to talk, I'm here. Please, you know, if you need to vent your spleen, I'm the person. I'm here for you." And you know, that worked out a couple of times, I guess. Do you find that? We are better, though, to end our conversation, I guess, on sort of an up note. Are we in a better place now, maybe even since the pandemic, of acknowledging that young people have mental health struggles?
I do. I think we've eliminated some of the stigmas around having open conversations about this, both in the context of school and at home. And we need diverse coalitions to come together and keep thinking about, you know, new solutions to this challenge. It's not new, like you said, and also it's longstanding. It's getting worse. So what can we do to help our young people feel as good as they can?
Right. Parents need to be thinking about it. And Romy, before we go, if you're a young person listening to this conversation and you're feeling, well, not so great, right? To really, again, generalize it, obviously not a medical term, but you're feeling down. What is the first step for you? Do you go to your parent? Do you go to the school? What should you do?
Go to someone who you trust, whether that is a teacher, a parent, or maybe even a friend if you're an older student. Just start a dialogue. I think in my conversations with students, there's a lot of students providing peer support, and they also know when to escalate tricky situations. So my advice to students is feel open, feel like you can talk about this. I'm glad we're talking about it today.
Yeah, it is. It is really so important to remove that stigma and get young people feeling comfortable in having this important discussion. Well, Romy Drucker, thank you so much. Such an education with the Education Program Director of the Walton Family Foundation on this today, World Mental Health Day. Romy, thanks very much.
Great to talk to you.
Great to talk with you. Right now, we want to bring you a voice that you might be familiar with. Rob Blanchard is in the studio with us. He is the Democratic candidate for the 28th District, the Connecticut State Senate, repping Bethel and Easton and Fairfield and Newtown and probably some other places that I may or may not be mentioning. Rob, so great to have you here in the studio.
Great to be here, Bridget. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So for people who might not know you, let's talk a little bit about your background. Chief of Staff to the State Comptroller, correct?
Correct. So currently I serve as the Chief of Staff to the State Comptroller, which is the office that oversees Connecticut's pension, health care, and budget. And prior to that, I had spent some time in the private sector doing communications for financial services. And before that, I spent several years with Governor Lamont and his administration doing a lot of communications, especially during the pandemic with towns and small businesses. And so I have a lot of experience on the other side of government and sort of excited to put that experience to work in this run for the state Senate.
Yeah. So in your capacity as a chief of staff to the state comptroller, fair to call you a money guy?
My wife would say different when she looks at our bank account, but yes, I think we're kind of serve as the chief financial officer for the state, which means we handle a lot of the check, you know, we're the checkbook unofficially. So we send payroll to employees. We send we pay a lot of the invoices and purchasing for the state, procurement, and we also monitor the budget through the letter of the first, which tells the general public, whether we've got a surplus or a deficit, and kind of how the budget is progressing throughout the year.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, you have to know how to crunch numbers for the job you have. I just want to remind our listeners that they might still not be used to calling in during these hours, Newsline being a new show, but we are taking your calls. Perhaps you have a question for Rob Blanchard. We are at 203-333-9422 right here on WICC. One more time, 203-333-9422. All right, so I want to get into the different issues that are important to
Absolutely.
Connecticut residents. But first of all, in a nutshell, why are you running?
So I'm running because, like a lot of middle-class families, and my wife and I, we just had a baby 2 weeks ago. And
congratulations.
Thank you. So I'm glad
how are you awake?
Well,
right
I'm glad
now.
We're on radio and not broadcast, so you can't see the bags underneath my eyes. But, you know, we're dealing with what a lot of young families and even small businesses and seniors are, which is the challenges around the cost of living. And that's really what the affordability crisis has definitely been my top priority. And that's everything from being able to find a home that we can afford, because we're right now in a two-bedroom apartment that we rent with two dogs. Like I said, it feels smaller and smaller every day. And that's not by choice, because we'd love to afford a home in Fairfield where my wife grew up and her parents grew up and grandparents grew up. But right now we couldn't afford even the home that she grew up in, for example. And so that's an issue that I definitely want to address. And we've obviously talked a lot about utilities and how they're not only expensive for families, but they're sometimes a deterrent for businesses who want to move into the state as well. And then especially in Fairfield County, we deal with transportation issues, Metro North, 95, 84, if you're up near Newtown area. And it can really, again, be an economic deterrent for folks. And so I want to use, like I said, my experience, but also kind of bring some newer ideas and a fresher perspective to some of the challenges facing our state. Because as Governor Lamont has done a great job turning the state around economically and kind of really promoting that Connecticut is a place that's open for business and wants to have business and people to start businesses here and raise their families here. I really want to be a partner in kind of promoting that economic message, and that starts with our budget next year and making sure that we're being responsible with our spending and cutting taxes where we can.
Let's focus a little bit on affordability. Obviously, as you say, a big issue. And we actually moved back to Connecticut. We found it more affordable, but that's because we were coming from a very high tax area of New York. So I don't count. But for a lot of people, it is really tough. And Rob, why is that? I mean, is it a matter of just not enough inventory, not enough affordable places to live?
It's a combination of things, right? We have seen an influx of people into our state, which is great. The governor always said, I want to turn the moving vans around. And I think especially in places like Fairfield County, that's happened. People are seeing that Connecticut, you can have a great quality of life, great schools. But there is a housing shortage in our state. And certainly within the country, there's more people that want to live in places, especially in the Northeast, than housing that's available. And as someone who served on planning and zoning, I know the issue of housing can be controversial in some communities, and that's why I think we really do need a balanced approach to it. You know, as much as my wife and I have an apartment that's connected to a train station, so it's great when she used to commute to Manhattan, or if we wanted to take the train one stop downtown to the Fairfield Theater Company, it's not a backyard for our son. So I think finding ways to, rather than do these huge, four or five story, hundreds of units in some towns, we need to look at more middle housing, townhouses, duplexes that allow families like myself to get a little more for their buck, but also be able to save eventually for a house as well. I similar to you, my wife and I spent some time in Brooklyn, and I joked that we moved back to Fairfield where she grew up, but we didn't leave New York rents. And so it's really tough to save up for a house, but also pay these exorbitant rents.
It is. So if you are elected, what do you do? How will you go about getting more affordable housing built? And how do you convince people in some neighborhoods who might not be amenable to the idea of more housing? How do you persuade them that, hey, look, this is going to be just fine?
So I call it accessible housing, housing that doesn't feel, and that's got different connotations, but I call it housing that doesn't feel out of reach. When my wife and I go to Zillow and we see $1.2 million houses, that feels out of reach, and we make good money, the two of us. So I think you really need to be collaborative with towns, developers, and the state to ensure that developers aren't taking advantage of some of these grants that may clean up brownfields or take these capes where they'll level them and put up all these larger complexes, and really make sure that everyone's working together and we've got comprehensive local plans of development that align with the community's infrastructure, the schools, the police and fire, and that doesn't sort of tip the scale one way or another when it comes to development. And unfortunately, we've seen in parts of Fairfield, especially in the district that I represent on the RTM, developers take advantage of some of these loopholes or laws that you've heard, A30G, and really jam a lot of housing in there. And that's why we've got some imbalance in the schools and a lot of development on one side of town and sort of not a cohesive plan of development.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have a caller. Lo and behold, I gave out that. It happened. We got a caller on the line. Mike from Fairfield. Go ahead. Do you have a question for Rob Blanchard?
Yeah, Mr. Blanchard, I don't know if this it doesn't really fall into any category, but I'm going to switch it to the other side, the retiree side. I'm 69 years old, live in Fairfield, and I'm still working part-time. And they have a very good tax break, even for someone making $77,000. The issue I have with that policy is they take it off your Social Security number, and they take it off prior to – they include the amount you pay in. For my scenario, I pay in $2,000 to my Part A and B, and they count that as income to me, even though I pay it back to Social Security towards the getting on the list of a deduction for taxes. And they say it's a state issue, not a town issue. You know anything about that?
So, well, thanks for calling in, Mike. And I definitely salute you for still working at 69. I feel, a lot of folks, sometimes it's a choice. They want to continue to work because they would either be restless in retirement. I think I'm in that category. And there's some folks like my parents that may not be able to retire because, again, of these affordability issues. And so seniors like yourself are definitely at the top of my list as well when it comes to these affordability issues. In short, I think that we do need to look at pensions and Social Security and ensuring that seniors can deduct that in a way that allows them to stay in Connecticut and be more affordable for them as well. I do think I've heard some good stories about the senior tax relief program that the town has implemented for folks. But I do think from a state level, especially on the income tax, that's definitely worth looking into. And if you leave your information, I'll look into it, especially in our office, in the comptroller's office, and get back to you on that as well.
Yeah, we'll get that information from Mike. Rob, thank you for fielding that question. Yeah, I guess that, you don't just want people to live in Connecticut. You want them to stay in Connecticut, which is, most certainly another challenge. Okay, so we are back with the Democratic candidate for the 28th District, Rob Blanchard, and we've been talking about affordability. And let's talk a little bit, Rob, about the topic of poverty. You no doubt saw that article this week. What was in the Connecticut Mirror, among other places, United Way, with this report. I couldn't wrap my brain around this. 2 out of 5 households lack the income to cover what they call a survival budget. I'm not 100% clear on what a survival budget is, but it doesn't sound good. What's your takeaway from that study, and what would you do about it?
So I did see this study, and I believe it. I think a lot of families are keeping it together, and that's certainly challenging and no way that anybody wants to live paycheck to paycheck. And I know that behind closed doors, a lot of families are stressed about bills and mortgage and student loans for their children or car payments. And I sympathize with them because that's certainly sort of the situation I had growing up as well. And So I bring a lot of that experience to this role and that understanding of families that want to succeed, that want to get ahead. And I think, there's only so much in the world that we can control from a state legislative standpoint when it comes to things like gas. There's obviously market forces beyond what the legislature can do, but we can make things less expensive for folks by not either overtaxing or adding unnecessary fees to things. So what I really want to do is institute things like a child tax credit for young families. We did it in 2022, and a lot of families that I'd heard from that were eligible for it, that took advantage of it, were able to pay for things at the onset of inflation, like music lessons that summer for their kids, or camp, or art lessons. And when kids were going through the pandemic, that sort of emotional opportunity to learn was really great, and it didn't strap families even further financially. I think things like the earned income tax, expanding that is going to be really helpful for families. And I think continuing to hold the line on things like the income tax or even cutting it, as the Governor Lamont has done, is going to be really important. People, as tough as it can be sometimes in Connecticut, they know that their children are getting a great education. They love their friends and their neighbors and the communities that they've built here, all 169 unique towns. And as expensive as it is sometimes, people know that they're getting value in a lot of ways when it comes to the schools or the roads. But what they want is predictability a lot of times. And that's where the frustration with the July utility bills came in. It was, I've budgeted $100 this month, but now it's $300. And I don't know where I'm going to get that extra $200 from. And so on the RTM, we passed a resolution encouraging the legislature to look at things like aggregation pricing that sort of caps the utility spikes and makes it more predictable so you don't see those spikes in the summer. Another issue that young families deal with is the cost of childcare. I hear from a lot of families that it's either cheaper to have one person stay at home and raise the children, and that unfortunately gets them out of the job market, which isn't great, especially if they've gone to school or training for to be a nurse or a teacher. And that's why I think programs like Care for Kids that helps to subsidize childcare a little bit need to be looked at and expanded, because in places like Fairfield County, where the income and the cost of living is higher, some of those families may not be eligible. And so incentivizing families to take advantage of those programs, people to spur growth in childcare to make it less sort of supply and demand issue is certainly one of the issues that I'm excited to look at and think we need to address.
Right. With the summer spike in utility bills, a lot of people are looking at a tough winter, right, of expenses. Anything you can do immediately? I mean, obviously, you have to see if you get elected, but yeah, anything to provide more immediate relief to Connecticut residents?
So I think what's come up a lot is this issue of immediate relief, and some of the Republicans in the legislature have demanded that everyone goes into a special session to provide immediate relief. And one of the, I've heard a few different avenues for going that route. One is to claw back the ARPA money that they allocated for one time, or in this case, continuous expenses. That was the $300 million at the end of the legislative session that went to higher education, mental health, and other nonprofit services. My concern with clawing that money back is, are you going to then see more need for mental health services? Are you going to see tuition increase because higher ed doesn't have that money now? And so people are going to be paying for that in other ways. The other challenge is if you move the public benefits, which we've heard a lot, into the budget, we've got a spending cap. So what are we crowding out now to then pay Eversource and UI back? And I get the frustration. It is outrageous, and we are one of the most expensive states in the country for utilities, and it needs to get under control. But when I go door-to-door and I talk with people about their bills and I say, the plan right now that's being proposed is to claw back ARPA and reallocate it to the utilities. And so if you're a UI customer, you may see $1.50 to $3 off your bill per month for a few months. Does that sound like relief for you? And if you're Eversource, it could be $4 to $5. Does that sound like relief for you? And they say no. And I agree with them. That doesn't feel like relief when the cost of everything else is going up. And it feels gimmicky in an election year. And so people want long-term solutions to these problems. And it can't be done overnight. It can't be done before November in a meaningful way. And unfortunately, it took years in the making to deregulate our utilities. And it's going to take years to kind of get it under control. But we've got a generation problem. And so we need to look at ways, whether it's nuclear or collaborating with other states or other renewables like solar and wind, which sometimes can be unfortunately expensive with the upfront capital. But we need to generate more power to sort of bring those costs down.
Mm-hmm. Need to look at the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. As it were, we're almost out of time, and I have so many other things to talk to you about. I guess, kind of briefly, if you could, how do you improve gun safety laws? Obviously, a huge thing in Connecticut.
It's a huge thing, and another one of the major differences between me and my opponent. You know, we've seen, unfortunately, how the shootings on campuses and public places have gone up, and I think things like red flag laws, which my opponent opposed, they can save lives, and they do save lives. We've seen the Republican caucus propose numerous dozens of amendments, and he's voted for a lot of them to weaken things like safe storage and assault weapons and background checks. And so I really want to make sure that people feel safe. I've heard from parents that they feel unsafe dropping their kids off at school, and they want to see them when they pick up. But I think we need to strengthen those laws, and I'm definitely committed to doing that and making sure that people feel safe and that we get guns off our street and that we work with police and law enforcement to enforce those laws and keep people feeling safe no matter where they are.
All right. We are coming up on Election Day. I can't believe it. 3 weeks from Tuesday, and you've been listening to Democratic candidate for the 28th District, Connecticut, State Senator candidate Rob Blanchard, representing, he hopes, Bethel and Easton and Fairfield and Newtown. And thank you so much for your time today, coming into our studios here at WICC and helping our listeners get to know you a little bit better. And with a newborn at home, I wish you a good night's sleep. Your first baby?
Absolutely, yes. Aww. It's our first.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Bridget.
So nice to have you here.
Likewise.
Appreciate it.
Thanks
Thank you so
on.
Much.